Today, let's lobby hard to build yet more homes. The DFA Daily to the 19th of August 2020. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. What an latest post covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour and with a touch of philosophy on the side. The phony war ahead of the October budget is now well in play. All the vested interest groups are coming out and making huge claims for support from a government which is heavily influenced by and aligned with the construction and finance sectors. Development approvals for new housing this year sank to their lowest level in close to a decade, with building levels nearly one-fifth down on long-term trends in some areas, according to recent analysis. And consultancy group Area Search's director and former head of research at Charter Hall Group, Chris Freeman, said a similar situation laid the groundwork for a 2014 boom in prices. Underbuilding in the years after the global financial crisis in 2009, coupled with a sudden drop in interest rates, created a supply and demand imbalance that sent prices skyrocketing, he said. With rates expected to stay at record lows for years to come, the next housing shortage could have a pronounced effect on the market once confidence returns, he said. One key factor for Sydney now is approvals relative to the population base, which at 0.62 approvals per 100 people in population is the lowest in recent history, he said. In a normal market, Australia as a whole adds about one dwelling approval per 100 people on average each year. A critical indicator of the looming undersupply was that Sydney was building fewer homes relative to the population than in 2013, just before the market went into a period of strong growth, he said. Now, I have to say, though, this just does not chime with the facts. With plenty of new stuff still being built even now, population growth slowing thanks to lower migration, courtesy of COVID, and temporary workers leaving, this is pure spin. The Housing Industry Association has also claimed that dwelling commencements are forecast to slump to a 13-year low of 133,000 by June 2022, down a big 58% from a peak back in June 2018. And the solution is, of course, a big ramp-up in immigration to backfill demand, despite the current border restrictions and the fact that the population QE is part of our problem, not part of the solution. HIE's chief economist, Tim Reardon, said that prior to COVID-19, population growth had already fallen well below expectations as overseas migration and the natural rate of population growth fell. Left unchecked, this will lead to more subdued building activity over the decade ahead. Adding to this structural decline in population growth, the contraction in migration due to COVID-19 will further impede building activity over the decade. Due to this slower rate of population growth, we now expect starts to be around 172,000 by 2030, compared with 190,000 starts in our previous long-term forecasts. For comparison, in 2016, new home starts peaked at 234,000. This record number appears likely to be unparalleled for more than a decade. Population growth and the subsequent demand for housing was driving economic growth in Victoria prior to COVID-19, they said. The uncertainty around future migration activity is a greater risk to the long-term outlook for Victoria than in the other states. Population growth in Victoria has slowed in recent years, already falling well below expectations as overseas migration was constrained and the natural rate of population growth fell. Adding to this, the contraction in migration due to COVID-19 means that population growth will be slower than expected. This slower rate of population growth will weigh on the recovery of the economy and new home starts over the decade. Now, let's be clear. Ramping up immigration will lift the costs of housing, force more people to live in poorly built high-rise units that perhaps will turn into slums later, and create even more infrastructure bottlenecks and congestion. Big is not beautiful. And in a somewhat similar vein, Master Builders Chief Executive Daniel Wan is advocating for first home buyers early access to up to $50,000 of their superannuation funds to build or purchase their first homes, alongside a $5 billion construction stimulus in the October budget. Ms. Warren said Mr. Frydenberg should allow compulsory super to be used to help people enter the housing market as quickly as possible, as well as having adequate retirement savings. Giving people a sizable chunk of their super, for example, at $50,000, will make a substantial difference, she told The Australian. Access to anything less would be a meaningless gesture that won't go any way close to solving the problem. The deposit gap will be accentuated in this current recession. Yet we know that if people can get out of the rental cycle and into their own home, it can provide a valuable financial foundation for their long-term future. Her comments come as new forecasts show slow migration and the wider economic impact of the COVID-19 pandemic will push home construction rates far lower over the next decade. The lobby group also called on the government to support a 12-month extension to the Home Builders Scheme and a $3.8 billion Community Builder Program to boost the commercial construction sector. But consider this. Opening the taps for more first-time buyers will once again lift the price of property for this group by the amount of the incentive. This is a zero-sum game, and on top of that, given low migration and the spare properties we already have across Australia, the last thing we need is to build yet more. Both the HIA and Master Builders are talking their book to the benefit of the big construction companies, not to the benefit of individual prospective purchasers. These are bribes, pure and simple, using taxpayer funds that could be so much better used elsewhere. The question is, of course, will the government simply roll over again? Well, on past track records, I will say they probably will. And this from the Department of Home Affairs. The number of temporary visa holders in Australia fell by 167,000 in the year to June 2020, as migrants have headed home following the COVID-19 pandemic. The overall net movement, including Australian and New Zealand citizens and permanent residents in July, was negative 38,480. For the 4 months March to July 2020, a total of 137,000 temporary entrants have departed Australia. The major contributors of this outcome have been students at negative 34,780, visitors at negative 40,890, temporary work a negative 31,570, temporary other categories, mainly temporary graduates, at negative 26,430, and temporary skilled workers at negative 4,100. The significant developments in July were driven by the large increase in student and temporary graduate departures, and that led to a net student outcome in July of negative 12,090 and a temporary other categories outcome in July of negative 10,550. In addition, there was a negative movement of Australian and New Zealand citizens, as well as the negative movement of permanent skilled migrants. So that meant that more left than arrived. And the overall international net movement outcome for the 4 months, March to July, was negative 110,000. As much of the July outcome will contribute to net overseas migration, the government's forecast of net overseas migration for 2021 of positive 31,000 looks, well, very, very optimistic. But actually, this is good news for the thousands of Australians out of work. We still have too many people on temporary visas, which were introduced, by the way, to plug gaps in skills here. Now, that is the last problem we face, as having temporary visa holders remaining in Australia to compete against locals for scarce jobs makes no sense and will force wages even lower. So let them go. And of course, they won't need property either. Indeed, as Macro Business put it today, lower immigration could unambiguously reduce one of the major drags on Australia's productivity, rising infrastructure bottlenecks and congestion, and it would lower the Australian dollar, other things being equal, rebalancing the economy away from Ponzi growth towards productive, tradable growth, and would help to lift wages, and it would improve Australia's current account, since Australia would import far less, and the nation's mineral wealth and exports would be shared among less people. Returning to the mass immigration big Australia policy post-COVID will only further stifle productivity, worsen the unemployment queues and further depress wages, smashing Australia's working class. And the latest from Westpac shows that their leading index growth rate remains in deep negative territory, consistent with recession. However, it appears to have bottomed out in April at minus 5.61%. And without the recent disaster in Victoria, it seems certain the June quarter would have marked the low point in the growth cycle. Victoria represents around 25% of national output, and Westpac expects the hard lockdown following the renewed virus outbreak to see the Victorian economy contract by about 9% in the September quarter, and that will offset the ongoing recovery that they expect to see unfolding in other states as they continue to reopen, albeit at varying speeds. For Australia overall, they expect growth in the economy to be flat in the September quarter before lifting by 2.8% in the December quarter on the assumption that Victoria moves through stage 4 down to stage 2 and other states avoid second wave outbreaks. The leading index growth rate has now lifted 1.24 percentage points out of what was a deep hole in April, growth relative to trend bottoming at down 5.61%. That has been led by strong initial rebounds in two components, US industrial production adding 1.75 percentage points and hours worked adding 0.78 percentage points. However, these gains have been materially offset by deterioration in several other components, including dwelling approvals down 0.47 percentage points and the Westpac Melbourne Institute Unemployment Expectation Index down 0.43 percentage points and the Westpac Melbourne Institute Consumer Expectations Index down 0.31 percentage points. Indeed, the three-monthly improvement would have been about double the size and much more convincing if it had not been for the renewed weakening in these other components. In the case of sentiment-based components, the weakness since April clearly captures the initial impact of the Stage 4 lockdown in Victoria, which saw a particularly disturbing nationwide drag on confidence in August. The Reserve Bank Board meets next month on September the 1st, and they say that we can expect the board to maintain current policies. From a policy perspective, the next major event will be the Commonwealth Budget, which will be announced on October the 6th. Westpac expects the government will be committed to providing generous ongoing support to the economy. However, most of this support, they say, is likely to be of a non-recurring form, including bringing forward the July 2022 tax cuts, one-off payments and infrastructure spending. And finally, ANZ reported their quarter three update today with a cash profit from continuing operations of $1.498 million, which was up significantly on the first half 20 average. Now, that included better than expected markets performance, which was up 60% on the first half 20 average. But against that, the net interest margin was weak in the third quarter, averaging 1.59% and down from 1.69% in the first half. Their better-than-expected cash earnings result was largely due to a lower-than-expected bad and doubtful debt charge of $500 million, and ANZ still added to its collective provision coverage, which now stands at 1.25% of credit risk-weighted assets, compared with 1.17 at March, and compared to CBA at 1.44%, NAB at 1.28% and Westpac at 1.53%. 90-day plus delinquency levels in the Australian home loan book increased up 18 basis points to 1.28% and was due to customers that were impacted by COVID-19 but ineligible for deferrals. In fact, 90,000 mortgage customers have gone into COVID-19 relief. Of those, 6,000 have completed or unwound deferral arrangements, leaving 84,000 or $31 billion of home loan balances still on deferral. This is 12% of total home loan balances. On the deferrals, ANZ said two-thirds have stable or improved incomes, one-third have made at least one payment while on deferral, and 95% have a savings buffer of some sort. And there were 22,000 accounts in the commercial sector on deferral, which is worth about $9.5 billion of exposure, or 14% of total commercial loans. 3% of business loan deferrals have been partially or fully unwound. Of the deferral cohort, only 6% is unsecured, which, by the way, is consistent with NAB. The CET1 ratio is 11.1% and is 30 basis points ahead of what was implied by the earlier data. On account of better profitability, but also tight management of risk-weighted assets in the institutional bank, mainly international businesses. As a result, ANZ declared a 25-cent fully franked 2020 interim dividend in line with the guidance from APRA. And that, of course, contrasts with Westpac, which we discussed yesterday, who announced no dividend. But standing back, you can see all the parties are lining up to try and lobby the government to support the construction and housing sector, despite the fact that I don't think that's where the spending should be placed. There are many other imperatives that should be receiving higher priority. And, of course, the mortgage question and how many delinquencies there really are will run and run. Remember that it took 3 to 4 years for the worst of the poor performance of loans to show after the global financial crisis. So in a way, we are only in the low foothills of defaults, and I expect more of that ahead. So we're going to continue to monitor it as it runs. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.